Today, Friday, August 22nd, this is the NPR News Update podcast. Welcome, I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, just how many candidate debates are needed? A Twin Cities teen forms a super PAC. Medtronic shareholders question a merger with an Irish firm. A health clinic closes its doors in part because of the new health care law. And is it really safe in those state fair animal barns? Also, an assessment of state fair gastronomy. First, Metro Transit and St. Paul City officials are trying something new this week in hopes of speeding up the Green Line light rail trains. Laura Ewan reports.
At three intersections along University Avenue in St. Paul, traffic signals have begun giving the trains more priority over cars. Ever since passenger service launched 2 months ago, trains have frequently gotten stuck at stoplight intersections, causing delays. The mayor's policy director, Nancy Homan, says as part of this limited experiment, traffic engineers will watch how the changes affect wait times for pedestrians, bicyclists, and drivers who are trying to cross the avenue.
If it goes as we hope and expect, then we can start to evaluate some additional intersections.
Metro Transit says the trains are averaging 52 minutes to travel between Union Depot in St. Paul and Target Field in Minneapolis. That's 4 minutes slower than scheduled. Still, Green Line ridership numbers have surpassed projections with about 31,000 trips a day. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Republican Senate candidate Mike McFadden kicked off the state fair yesterday by making a personal appeal to Senator Al Franken to agree to six debates. Here's Mark Zedeklik.
The McFadden campaign claims Franken is avoiding debates because he does not want to answer criticism that he votes with the Obama agenda an overwhelming majority of the time. McFadden says several more debates are needed so Minnesotans can make the best decision in the fall election.
I hope he takes me up on that challenge because I believe the good people of Minnesota deserve to hear my views and my vision for getting this country moving forward, as contrasted to Senator Franken.
Someone dressed in a chicken suit stood in front of the Republican State Fair booth holding a sign that read, "Al Franken, too chicken to debate." Franken says he's not afraid to debate and that he's agreed to three more debates, which he says are enough, on top of the Farm Fest Forum earlier this month. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the State Fair.
The candidates for governor are also sparring over the number of debates they should hold before Election Day. Republican Jeff Johnson issued a challenge to DFL incumbent Mark Dayton yesterday at the fair. Tom Scheck has more.
Jeff Johnson used the first day of the state fair to criticize Governor Dayton for declining an invitation from NPR News to debate at the fair. He called on Dayton to take part in 13 debates between now and November 4th, including two at the state fair. Johnson said Dayton is ducking debates.
I think everybody is ready to hear where we differ and what our visions are for the state of Minnesota, so now is the time to do it rather than waiting another 2-3 weeks.
Johnson said the state fair debate would allow the candidates to interact with everyday Minnesotans. For Johnson, that give and take started before his news conference even ended. That's because union pipefitter Matt Pfau of Corcoran asked Johnson why Republicans always campaign against unions.
Trust me, I'm not a diehard liberal, but I have to vote to keep my job, which keeps me on the Democratic side. You guys learn to play with the unions better. You can have that whole 16 to 18% of the vote and swing every election.
Johnson told Pfau that he grew up in a union household and represented employers and unions as an attorney. He then shifted the discussion to ways to improve the economy.
We're probably not going to agree about all union-related issues, but I think it's really important that Republicans, Democrats, and everybody else understand that a big chunk of the population are hardworking people, whether they're in unions or not. And what we ought to be talking about is how to grow the economy so that everybody can get a better job.
Johnson said he intends to appear at the fair nearly every day and hopes to spend more time interacting with voters like Pfau. But his attempts to make headlines over his debate challenge was overshadowed when Dayton made an even bigger splash at the state fair.
Three, two, one.
Dayton took part in the Ice Bucket Challenge, aimed at raising money to fight ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Dayton agreed to have the bucket of cold water dumped on his head during conservative talk radio host Joe Soucheray's live broadcast at the fair. Dozens of onlookers, TV cameras, and reporters were there to capture the event. Dayton said he was looking for a way to take the challenge and raise awareness for the cause.
It's good fun. That's what the state fair is about, is having good fun.
It wasn't the only appearance Dayton made at the fair. He was interviewed on stage by a Star Tribune columnist and shook hands at the DFL party booth. One thing Dayton won't be doing is debating Jeff Johnson at the fair. He said Johnson's debate request is a contrived issue. Dayton said he'd debate six times, three times in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and three times in rural Minnesota. He said Johnson should lay out where he stands on the issues before any debates take place.
I think he should go around the state and lay out his positions. He says he wants to talk about business climate, talk about it. He claims everybody's leaving. Why do we have the lowest unemployment rate of any metropolitan area and unemployment, low unemployment rates all over the state of Minnesota? Let's hear him put some flesh on the bones, and then we'll have something to debate.
Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, Falcon Heights.
Billy Cerwinski didn't want to wait until he was old enough to vote to get involved in politics. So the 17-year-old Minnetonka High School student went ahead and started his own super PAC. And Billy joined Steve and John in the studio yesterday to talk more about Americans for a Better Yesterday Tomorrow.
What made you want to start a super PAC?
I kind of care about the issue of campaign finance regulation, and I figured it'd be a kind of interesting way to get involved with it and kind of get the word out about what's going on.
Was it part of a school project or what?
Yeah, I had a school project. I had to do a research paper. And so for my topic, I chose campaign finance regulation. And I guess just to kind of spruce up the project, I decided that a super PAC would be the way to go.
Was it difficult to file the required paperwork?
It took me like a grand total of 10 minutes. Okay. It involves printing off a form from the FEC website and a letter to go along with it. And you just mail it off to their address, and a few weeks later, voila.
And there you go. What kind of a reaction did you get from, first of all, your teacher in the class?
Yeah, she was surprised. She wasn't too familiar with super PACs in general, and then just the fact that a student in her 11th grade AP Lit class was able to create something like this that works on a national scale as well as a state level was, I think she was a little bit taken aback by it.
Now that you've gone through the trouble of creating a super PAC, do you plan to actually utilize it? Are you going to raise money?
I don't know if I'll quite get to there yet. As of right now, it's just kind of a thing to gather, kind of garner awareness for it and kind of get people, I guess, educated on what's going on with this issue that not a lot of people really know about.
Now, the name of your super PAC sounds quite similar to that of humorist Stephen Colbert's Americans for a Better Tomorrow. Yeah. Was that by design?
Yeah, exactly. I watched the Stephen Colbert episode on his super PAC where he talks about kind of the different campaign regulations, and that's where I got the idea of, maybe I should just go ahead and create one.
Now, so what you've learned from super PACs from doing this project, anything surprise you about it?
It surprises me how easy it is for them to spend money and not send that information to places like the IRS, because you think that the IRS can know everything about different tax regulations and stuff like that. But because of the way the laws work and because of the loopholes, they really can report almost nothing to the IRS and to us as the citizens.
And the Twitter page for your super PAC says, just trying to revamp democracy.
Yeah.
Is that now kind of a secondary goal of yours to run with this?
Yeah, I think it is, because I think that campaign finance regulations have kind of shaped the face of our democracy since the Supreme Court case that allowed them to be created. And I think it's definitely going to be changing the face of politics on a national as well as a state level for many years to come here.
You obviously have a general interest in politics.
Yeah.
and did even before this. How has what you've learned about super PACs affected your faith in the U.S. political system?
I'm a pretty big patriot, so I have a lot of faith in the U.S. government. I know that not everything they do is exactly right or exactly what we as the citizens want them to be doing. So I guess you could say my faith hasn't really been shaken that much in them, but it's definitely made me want to get involved and make a change.
Now, you will be a Minnetonka High School senior this fall, a year from now. Will political science be a college focus?
Yeah, definitely. That's the one thing I am for sure on when it comes to college. I haven't quite decided on where I want to go to college, but political science will be involved in it for sure.
And then perhaps a career in politics?
Hopefully. That's what I want to end up doing. Maybe I can get involved and eventually make a change on a legislative scale.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you, Stephen.
You can read more about Billy Cerwinski and his super PAC on the Capital View blog on nprnews.org.
And that was Stephen John on All Things Considered. At Medtronic's annual shareholder meeting yesterday, several shareholders criticized a controversial proposed merger with Covidien. The chief concern is the deal will expose them to hefty capital gains taxes. Medtronic CEO Omar Ishrak said he sympathizes, but argued the deal is in the long-term interest of the company, shareholders, patients, and the U.S. Martin Moylan has more.
Medtronic is proceeding with a plan to buy Covidien, an Irish-based medical device maker, despite intense political heat. The $43 billion deal would let Medtronic move its legal headquarters for tax purposes from the Twin Cities to Dublin, Ireland. That's drawn criticism from some Democrats, including President Obama, who say so-called tax inversion arrangements are unpatriotic and, while legal, not the right thing to do. Medtronic, though, says its deal with Covidien won't reduce its U.S. taxes. In fact, the company argues the transaction will enable it to invest billions of dollars in foreign profits in the U.S. and do that while avoiding U.S. taxes on overseas profits that have already been taxed by foreign governments. The company says that, like many multinational corporations, it has kept foreign profits outside the U.S. to avoid double taxation. But the greatest point of contention at Medtronic's annual meeting was the capital gains hit the deal would create for individual shareholders. They'll be forced to exchange current Medtronic stock for shares in the new company and pay taxes on all the profits from the transaction.
This is the least shareholder-friendly proposal I have ever seen.
Arthur Binger of Maple Grove has been a Medtronic shareholder for more than 20 years. He was among the small investors criticizing the Covidien deal.
Shareholders may need to sell stock to pay taxes. They will have to pay capital gains tax anywhere in the range of 20 to 35%. They may need to sell stock in order to accomplish that.
Another older investor, Patricia Hartlob of New Brighton, told Ishrak that many longtime loyal Medtronic investors in their golden years don't have much time to wait for new stock price gains to offset capital gains taxes.
If you look out at the group of people here, as well as long-term stockholders, long-term for us is short. So it's difficult to make up 35 to 40%.
Ishrak said he sympathizes with the predicament shareholders face, and he indicated the company will provide tax advice. Medtronic's stock price has doubled in the past 3 years, but depending on when they bought shares, shareholders may have seen far greater investment gains. Ishrak repeated his defense of the deal. He lamented that U.S. tax policies have prompted companies to keep trillions of dollars in profits offshore.
All we're doing is using that cash and investing it in the U.S., and how can that be bad for the U.S.? And we're going to invest it in medtech, in an area that we've got proven capability to improve patients' lives and to make a difference in healthcare. And that'll improve jobs, high-paying jobs that'll be brought to the U.S. in medtech.
Ishrak said Medtronic's U.S. tax bill won't change.
We're not going to pay any less taxes in the U.S. after the transaction than before. And in fact, we've committed to invest in $10 billion into the U.S., into Minnesota, over the next 10 years. So we pay the same taxes and we invest more.
Assuming it wins required shareholder, regulatory, and government approvals, Medtronic expects the deal for Covidien will close late this year or early next year. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A health clinic in Minneapolis that provides medical care to thousands of uninsured and underinsured people is closing its doors next week. The Neighborhood Involvement Program says revenue is down 30% at its Uptown clinic because more people are getting health insurance through the Affordable Care Act and seeking care elsewhere. But clinic managers say a need remains for the low-cost care they provide. Matt Sepik reports.
Compared to the eye-glazing complexity of most medical bills you'd see today, the ones at the Neighborhood Involvement Program clinic on Hennepin Avenue are as easy to understand as a restaurant check. And the price list at NIP reads like a menu: $10 for a strep test, $80 for a basic doctor visit. If your monthly income is less than $1,900, those fees drop considerably. considerably. The NIP Community Medical Clinic, known for many of its 42 years as the Uptown Clinic, was there at exactly the right time for Julie Wethington of Minneapolis. She lost her health insurance when she was laid off from her job a few years ago. Around the same time, she began having knee problems. Wethington says she's grateful for the clinic's low prices and flexibility with billing.
I just try to pay it all as I go. Once in a while, I wasn't able to, but then I caught up to it like a week or two later.
Wethington turned 65 this summer and now has Medicare. Nevertheless, she says she's sad to see the clinic close because she knows there are many people who still need its services, but there aren't as many as there were. Because of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, a large number of NIP's clients now have health insurance through MinSure, and they have more provider choices than before the law went into effect this year. Others qualified for Medicaid when the state expanded eligibility to 35,000 low-income adults. Patsy Bartley, the CEO of the NIP clinic, says the drop in paying patients has resulted in a 30% cut in revenue since January. Even with a mostly volunteer staff of doctors and nurses, Bartley says that's unsustainable.
That's a huge drop for us to be able to continue to provide our infrastructure to do this work.
Bartley says foundation grants have also shrunk because some funders mistakenly believe Obamacare has rendered charitable medical centers obsolete. The clinic took another financial hit from a mandated switchover to electronic medical records. Janet Tolsman, a nurse and co-director of the clinic, says some newly insured patients still visit because they can't afford the deductibles and co-pays that come with their insurance plans.
That was their trade-off for an affordable monthly payment. But then what happens when you do need to see a provider? All of a sudden, they're having monthly payments plus having to figure out how to do the whole out-of-pocket expenses.
Tolsman also says they see patients who remain without health insurance. A MinSure spokesman says the agency has helped cut the number of uninsured Minnesotans by more than 40%, but that's still not everyone. Nicole Lamoureux with the National Association of Free and Charitable Clinics says demand will remain for the low-cost health care services that the NIP clinic and others like it provide.
In Minnesota, even after the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, there will be 243,000 people who will be left without access to health insurance. And that's a great number of people, and that's where you will see that the free and charitable clinics, as well as other members of the safety net, will continue to provide care.
Rachel Garfield, a researcher at the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C., says the uninsured in Minnesota include newly arrived as well as undocumented immigrants and people who find it's cheaper to pay a tax penalty rather than an insurance premium. Garfield says charitable clinics are in a tough spot. Revenue is down because more people have insurance and may choose to go elsewhere. But the clinics need to keep their doors open for the uninsured and underinsured.
What these clinics are facing now is a challenge, I think, in trying to maintain revenue sources that they're getting from different subsidies and different private sources while they're still trying to serve these individuals.
The Neighborhood Involvement Program clinic closes its doors a week from today, leaving its 3,000 patients without a medical provider. But NIP's dental and mental health clinics, as well as its senior and youth programs, will continue operating in Uptown. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
With the Minnesota State Fair underway, we wondered, what are the health risks of spending time in the animal barns? Earlier this month, an E. coli outbreak that sickened 13 people was traced to a traveling petting zoo that appeared at several Minnesota county fairs and festivals. 7 people were hospitalized and 2 patients developed serious kidney complications. The state fair says it offers one of the safest settings around for people to interact with farm animals, and it says fairgoers can make that experience even less risky by following a few simple rules. Lorna Benson reports.
Wandering through the animal barns, listening to the indignant squeals of jostling pigs, or watching a 1,500-pound cow unfurl its long tongue to snag an out-of-reach kernel of grain is one of the great pleasures of the Minnesota State Fair. And yet these animals, even bathed and brushed to perfection, carry germs that can make people sick. Besides E. coli, other potentially dangerous pathogens spread by farm animals include salmonella, campylobacter, and influenza.
And if you know that, when you walk in the door, then you behave differently.
Joni Scheftel is the state public health veterinarian, and she wants fairgoers to feel relaxed about visiting the animal buildings. There isn't a huge risk of contracting an animal disease just from walking through the fair barns. But Schefftel says you can reduce the risk that is there if you avoid touching your mouth and if you make sure you thoroughly wash your hands when you leave the barns. Many of the animal diseases that are harmful to humans are spread through infected manure. Manure gets cleaned up quickly at the fair, but remnants remain on the floor where animals rest, and that can be transferred to people's hands when they pet the animals later. And touching animals isn't the only way diseases spread.
It can happen if you carry food or drink into an animal building and sawdust and dust gets on the food and then you eat it that way.
Schefftel says pacifiers and bottles should also be put away while visiting the animal barns. And for toddlers and young children who might hang on barn gates to get a better view, the fair's Mark Goodrich urges parents to just make sure their kids aren't pressing their mouths against the rails.
We try to disinfect those areas numerous times during the day, and some of them up to numerous times an hour.
Goodrich is Deputy General Manager of Livestock and Competition. He says the state fair has done a lot in just the past 5 years to minimize the spread of disease between animals and humans. It has installed more than 24 hand-washing stations in its barns and posted signs at the building's entrances to warn people about animal diseases. In the swine barn, there's more concern about influenza viruses spreading between people and pigs through the air. Goodrich says that ventilation system has undergone a substantial upgrade.
We've increased the air that we're pulling into the building. The amount of air that we're pulling out is a phenomenal amount. We added the huge, large, like Casablanca fans. They're about 15 foot in diameter that move and stir the air.
The health department's Joni Schefftel agrees the state fair has invested a lot of effort into reducing health risks that were already quite low. The state tracks whenever someone is diagnosed with Salmonella, E. coli, or Campylobacter and follows up to see if a source for the infections can be found. Every 2 or 3 years, Schefftel says the health department links a handful of animal-to-human infections to the state fair, but she says that's not much when you consider that hundreds of thousands of fairgoers visit the animal barns each year.
We've never had what we call an outbreak. The only thing we've ever identified are small, family clusters among exhibitors, not visitors.
Schefftel says far more animal-to-human infections are linked to exposures on working farms or when people fail to properly cook meat at home. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Our Tim Nelson went to the fair yesterday, and like many of us at the Glutton Fest, his focus was food. He joined forces with Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl, who writes about food for Minneapolis St. Paul magazine.
Okay, Dara, we have roamed the fair far and wide today. We bonded over kimchi pickles. I applied sunscreen to your bare shoulders. We can speak frankly here. What are the takeaways from the 2014 Minnesota State Fair?
Sticks are over. Out of all the new foods, I think it's 28 official new foods, and there's a lot more unofficial ones, but only 4 were things in batter on a stick.
And I think there was one of them you didn't like very much, didn't you? Wasn't there one on your new one on your life grudge list?
Yeah, this would be the pancake breakfast on a stick. So it was like pancakes and eggs, 2 kinds of cheese, all of it kind of welded together with fresh pancake batter, deep fried. You could not get more grease if you got your oil changed. Like, there's so much oil and grease, disgusting.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there's a lot of frozen stuff at the fair this year. We've tried some of that.
I'm liking the frozen stuff. This might be the year of frozen. Everything good is frozen. Okay, so they got the whole Japanese crazy beer foam. It's made with blueberries. It's made with beer. It's over in the West End Market. You put it on top of either a special blueberry beer from Shell's or any one of the many Shell's beer. It's crazy. It's kind of good. I really like it.
And we stopped by the Blue Moon Diner there, and I think you really like the snow ribbon.
I did like the snow ribbons. They're fun. They have a big block of ice cream, and they turn it, and it turns into kind of shaved ribbons. It's a fluffy way to eat ice cream.
The other thing we saw a little bit of here is, I think you referred to it as stunt beer as we were walking by.
There's a lot of stunt beers. There's a s'mores beer over at Giggles from Flat Earth. There's the mini donut beer. They made 300 kegs of this. They've put a little sugar cinnamon rim up top like you do a salt rim for a margarita, but this has a cinnamon sugar rim for a beer.
And they sold out of that last year.
It was a full-on frenzy. It was mass riots in the street, hour waits. People were so excited. I mean, stampedes trying to get it. They've sold out again and again. This year, 300 kegs.
Anything surprise you here? Anything that sticks out to you?
Actually, I think it's a good year. I felt like the past couple of years, things were getting a little crazy, just trying to shove as many things onto a stick and then fry them. And I kind of like things are a little more authentic this year. I love that Mancini's bought a gelato machine, is making a whole bunch of gelato flavors. So they have a mini donut gelato and a salty caramel apple gelato and just things that are really fair, but they're very authentic, good, real, homemade stuff here.
And last thing, if you're only going to have one thing out here for your visit to the fair, what's it going to be?
If you're doing one thing, it's got to be the classics. Your pick, it's going to be mini donuts, roast corn, or cheese curds.
Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl, who writes about food for Minneapolis-St. Paul magazine, there with Tim Nelson at the fair. I'm Phil Picardi here in St. Paul. That's the week of Minnesota news through the NPR News Update lens. I'll be back on Monday with another podcast.